Unit 9. Comparative Accounting.
Text 9.1. What are brands worth? Accountants are divided over the treatment of intangible assets because they cannot make up their minds what balance sheets are for. Are they supposed to give a brave man's estimate of what a company is worth? Or are they to show, as they tend to in Britain, a cautious man's calculation of how much of a company's costs have not yet been written off against revenues? To some extent, it is up to companies to make up their auditors' minds for them. Price Waterhouse is auditor to both Reckitt and Coleman and Rowntree. Yet, unlike Reckitt and Coleman, Rowntree has never included in its annual report any valuation of its famous brands, such as Kit Kat, Polo, After Eight, and Smarties. When Nestlé offered to pay over £1 billion for something that did not appear in Rowntree's accounts, it confirmed many laymen's views that accountants must be asses. Since Nestlé's policy is also to write off trademarks and goodwill immediately against reserves, the value of Rowntree's brands has once again disappeared into an accounting black hole. Lowly status of marketing. The fact that few British companies have pushed their accountants to value their brands could have something to do with the lowly status of marketing in the corporate hierarchy. It may not be a coincidence that Jean-Claude Larrechet is a non-executive director of Reckitt & Coleman. Mr. Larrechet is professor of marketing at INSEAD, the International Business School outside Paris. No marketing director can be happy to see the fruits of his efforts totally ignored in his company's balance sheet. Mr. Larrechet may also have been influenced by France's example. Companies there keep intangible assets on their balance sheet. Unfortunately, this does not mean that they are any more consistent than the British. In France, the issue is not valuation, but depreciation. In general, intangibles protected by a legal right, such as trademarks and, peculiarly, leasehold rights to property, are not depreciated, whereas goodwill and others are. A recent EC draft directive suggests goodwill be written off over 5 years. In practice, France has a host of exceptions. In 1984, Printemps, the department store group, began to write off, over 40 years, some 50 million French francs of property rights, mostly related to its main store on Paris's Boulevard Haussmann. In its 1987 accounts, Pernod Ricard wrote off 289 million French francs of goodwill. That, said the company, was all the goodwill arising from mergers before December 31, 1987. Such practice was in accordance with the recommendations of the French National Council on Accounting Standards. The 245 million French francs of intangible assets remaining on the company's balance sheet at the end of 1987 related almost entirely to trademarks. On the other hand, Ron Poulon had almost 4 billion French francs of goodwill on its end of 1987 balance sheet. Its policy is to amortize goodwill over not more than 40 years. The problem of how to account for intangible assets will not go away. Indeed, it can only become more of a problem. Not only because companies are more conscious of the value of brands and more prepared to pay huge sums to buy them, but also because Europe's economies are increasingly becoming service economies. Service firms have few assets other than intangible ones. If their balance sheets continue to take no account of their most significant asset, then what use are they? It would be nice to think that accountants across Europe will find a common solution for the treatment of intangible assets. If they do, they will themselves have shown considerable goodwill to consumers of their accounts.
Text 9.2. Germans draw a line at two sets of accounts. UK accounts at least pay lip service to the notion that accounts should provide a true and fair representation of what's happening at the company. But German accounting does not aim to give outsiders such as analysts or investors a true or merely fair picture of a company's financial condition. If this makes it difficult for international fund managers to make informed investment decisions about German companies, it also denies German companies access to the world's largest capital market. The fact that not a single German company has a full listing in the US is directly due to German accounting. Last year, a number of Germany's largest companies, including Daimler-Benz, Bayer, Hoechst, and BASF, and a number of large banks approached the Securities and Exchange Commission in the U.S. with a view to obtaining a listing in the U.S. The talks came to nothing. The main obstacle was the SEC's requirement that the German companies, like all companies listed in the U.S., should comply with the generally accepted accounting principles, U.S. GAAP, in the U.S. The German companies refused to give way, and the SEC would not compromise, hence an impasse. The issue has rumbled on since then. Last month, the Federation of German Stock Exchanges said it was likely the European Commission would enter into direct negotiations with the SEC on behalf of all European countries. The EC may well take up the reciprocity argument used by the German companies last year, that a company which had complied with German listing requirements ought to qualify automatically for a listing in the U.S. without having to comply with the U.S. GAAP. Since German listing requirements are much less strenuous, U.S. companies have no difficulty gaining a quote there. Apart from the general principle that German companies give away very little financial information, the main practical difference between Teutonic accounting and the Anglo-American variety is that German accounting invariably understates both assets and profits as compared to figures presented under UK rules or US GAAP. An exercise conducted last year by Mr. Gary Schienemann, an analyst for Smith New Court in New York, showed that shareholders' equity at Mannesmann, a large German engineering company, at the end of 1989, would have been at least 40% higher if presented under US GAAP, while net profits would have been 50% and 36% higher in 1988 and 1989, respectively. In another study, Mr. Schienemann showed how the Volkswagen car company's 1989 profits would grow from 1.04 billion Deutschmarks under German rules to 1.5 billion Deutschmarks under UK rules and 1.9 billion Deutschmarks under US rules. In answer to the question, what did Volkswagen really earn in 1989, Schienemann was forced to conclude that it depended entirely on your accounting perspective. What was true for the 1989 figures applies equally to those produced by large German companies in 1990 and 1991, says Schienemann. The differences between the German and the UK and the US versions of the figures are in part due to German conservatism on specific issues such as accounting for goodwill and depreciation. But there are also more fundamental factors at work. Mrs. Heidrun Hasse of Deutsche Bank Research in Frankfurt identifies some of the underlying causes of the differences between German and Anglo-American accounting. German law insists that the interests of creditors take precedence over those of shareholders. The so-called Gläubigerschutzprinzip, in which this principle is enshrined, means that companies are under legal pressure to understate reported profits and assets. There is no distinction between tax accounts and published accounts, as there is in the UK or the US. The Maskeblickkeit-Prinzip ordains that in order to get a deduction for tax purposes, it must be booked in the published accounts. Thus, there is a cash incentive for German companies to keep reported profits as low as possible, because lower profits mean lower tax bills. The structure of the German capital market does not bring pressure on companies to ramp up their reported profits. Only about 650 German companies are listed on the stock market, and of these, the vast majority are controlled by banks or families with long-term investment horizons. These shareholders have access to the management accounts, which tell the full story denied to those who must rely on published figures. Despite recent developments, such as the Continental Pirelli saga and Krupp's takeover of Hirsch, there is no vigorous market for corporate control in Germany, and managers do not have to present spectacular profits growth to fend off takeover. A further unspoken reason why German companies do not want to present US-style figures is that it would weaken their hand in negotiations with unions. Germany's labor costs are already higher than anywhere else in Europe, and the fear is that they could get higher if the unions saw the profits restated upwards under UK or US GAAP.